Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I am thrilled for today's topic and for the wonderful panel that we've put together. A big shout-out, first of all, to Chelsea Rabarge-Fife, who many of you will know from being on the podcast in the past. But Chelsea does marketing, and one of her clients is Excel, which is the film publishing arm of Deseret Book. And she offered me a chance to go see a preview of a film called The Cokeville Miracle. And the invitation came at a time when a few weeks earlier, Freetown had come to theaters. And conversations that I'd had with friends and things like that kind of led me into just a general thought within my own brain of the interesting dynamics that come when films are made for particular audiences. And in this case, not necessarily just Mormon audiences, but clearly the Cokeville Miracle and Freetown are kind of geared towards groups that have faith at a basis and have certain beliefs in God and things like that. So what about art and film in a religious context, in contexts where you know you have an audience, and how does that affect it in terms of artistic merit? Can it exist both at a level of good art and good storytelling and making good money? Or is there always going to be compromises and various things that come along and kind of play with the dynamics of what's in the director's mind, what's in the script, what makes it to the screen versus the cutting room floor? And are these decisions always in service of story? Chelsea's invitation also came with the chance to have her work out a couple of guests that I never would have really thought to try to grab because I don't know them super well, but I'm thrilled to bring on board and to welcome for the first time today Arthur Van Wagenen and Sterling Van Wagenen. I'll have them introduce themselves in a minute. And as always, when I have a subject about storytelling and our lives and how influenced we are by stories and things like that, I always end up inviting Stephen Carter to be on. So thrilled to have him again. So a couple of quick things just to do, not necessarily big promote-y kind of announcements, just for those who are interested, as these subjects I'm sure will come up. Freetown has now left theaters, but XL does have the distribution for the DVD and Blu-ray, and that will be coming out on August 4th on through Amazon and Walmart and Deseret Book and things like that. So Freetown, available August 4th for those who missed it in the theaters. And then in theatrical release, The Cokeville Miracle will start hitting screens on June 5th. So that's coming up here in the next 10 days or so from when this is released. Stephen, thanks for being on again. Would you quickly remind everybody a little bit about your background and the subjects that we'll be talking about today?
Okay, I'm Stephen Carter, and I'm the editor at Sunstone. I have been for the past 7 years. And I'm also a comic book writer. In fact, I'm a Book of Mormon comic book writer. One of my comic books, it's called Eye Plates, like iPhone and golden plates put together, Eye Plates. We won a nice award from the Association for Mormon Letters. So I know a little bit about what it is to try to write something that balances between the demands of the market and kind of the story that you're after. And I also have a PhD in narrative studies. I spent a long time in Alaska studying stories that first-year teachers in rural Alaska told. These were the people who graduated from college in the lower 48 and then went straight up to an Alaskan native village and were surprised by what they found. That sounds like a clickbait headline.
For sure. And you actually made a film as part of your dissertation, or was your...
Oh, it's true.
Yeah. Yeah. So neat. Well, thank you, brother. We appreciate having you on. You're always super reflective and insightful when it comes to these meta issues of story and faith and dynamics and how we inhabit stories or stories and, you know, can take over our lives and all things like that. So it's wonderful. Sterling, I was thinking of you just a few minutes ago as perhaps the most famous person I've ever had on this podcast. But you seem to not really like the spotlight a whole ton. Are you going to reject that label, or would you go ahead and tell people some of the credentials that you have, even though I know you don't like ever want to, you know, be out front, but certainly you've been a big mover and shaker in culture. Would you mind introducing yourself?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, basically I've just been a filmmaker and a teacher over the course of my career and have occasionally wandered into the administrative wilderness. I was involved in the startup of the Sundance Film Festival and the Sundance Institute, and have also been a university administrator. I was the chair of a film department at the University of Central Florida for several years, and have made films, both features and documentaries, worked as a producer and director both. So it's in other words, I'm I don't know that I'm the most famous person, but I certainly qualify as a significant dilettante for sure.
Well, listen to a couple things. One of the films that you were a producer of won an Academy Award for Best Actress in Geraldine Page, A Trip to Bountiful. So many of our listeners will know that film. So congratulations on that. The other thing you left out of this is for a while, was it about 4 or 5 years, you held a role of director of content at BYU for all their TV and was it film as well?
Yeah, for BYU Broadcasting, I was the director. Actually, I had two stints at BYU Broadcasting. One was in the 90s as an executive producer, and then again in the I think until about two 2006 to 2010 or something like that. I was the director of content when BYU Television was just getting its start.
Awesome. And then you retired from there, and you've just been teaching up at the U of U?
Actually, I left BYU Broadcasting and took a full-time position at the LDS Church in the producers group in the film and video division, and at the same time I've been teaching in the film and media arts program at the University of Utah.
And then upcoming, you are going to be the director of a film that I think a lot of our listeners will have heard something about. It's called Heart of Africa. Would you quickly tell a little bit about that project?
Surely. This is a script by Margaret Blair Young, and it's quite a remarkable piece of work. We're trying to we're working on the script right now, and so we're not nearly finished. But the core of the story really is about two LDS missionaries working in the Congo. One is black and one is white, and they are in some sense of the term both racist. And the film is really how by working together they work through their racial bias and discover that really we're all failures at being good Mormons, and really the only answer is grace and the atonement.
Awesome. Great stuff.
Cool.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you involved with that. I've known Margaret working on that for quite a few years, so it's great.
Yeah.
Arthur, welcome to the show. You've kind of new to this world. A couple of years ago, you got a job with a well-known company. Would you tell us a little bit about your background and what your role is right now?
Yeah, my background is very easy to sum up. I am the son of Sterling. And that's all anybody really needs to know. And I get that everywhere I go. It's a very small film community in Utah, and it's a very small Mormon film community. And so I've been fortunate to have a bit of mentorship from my father, and so I'm known as the son of Sterling. I have yet to do anything as interesting or as influential as starting the Sundance Film Festival and the Sundance Institute. But I did, and Sterling was interesting. Growing up, he would always put on, you know, 5 minutes of a film. We always had to sit down. We'd roll our eyes every time he'd say, just watch 5 minutes of this or 5 minutes of that. So I got my film education sort of growing up watching watching films in the home.
Well, now was it 5 minutes and then you
well, if it always turned it,
yeah, if you want to keep going after it's captured you, right?
That's right. He was always hoping we'd stick it out for the rest of the film. But interestingly enough, he discouraged us from going into film, probably seeing the risks and the financial sort of uncertainty that the industry, that's inherent in the industry. So I ended up studying law after my undergraduate work at BYU. I went to the University of Utah Law School and clerked out at New Line Cinema. I ended up taking as many environmental law and intellectual property and entertainment law classes as I could, and just sort of ended up after that clerkship at out in Hollywood at an intellectual property firm in Salt Lake City called Workman Heidegger, and was working with another attorney named Joe Pia, who was starting to build a little entertainment practice. And we did a lot of work for independent filmmakers doing, you know, million and 2 million, just small independent feature films, putting their legal documents together and their contracts together and getting their investment documents all in order. So I kind of came to film through the business and legal side. But as you might expect in Salt Lake, it's difficult to sustain that kind of a practice. You end up doing a lot of other litigation and nasty lawyering things. And so the first chance I got, there was a little window to join a documentary company called Mirror Lake Films. So for 2 years, I was a partner in a documentary company with a couple of talented women producers and filmmakers, Chantel Squires Olson and Manju Lavargis. And we worked for a couple of years together before I moved over to XL Entertainment and took the role as director of that division, which is a division of Deseret Book Company.
Yes, and is it purely the visual arts, movies only, or is there a larger scope for XL?
Yeah, XL handles exclusively film. So I sort of function as a product director for film within the Deseret Book family, but I sat down with the CEO and president at the time, Sherry Dew, and had to sort of make a painful admission when I was interviewing for the job. And that admission was that I didn't own any of the DVDs on the shelf at Deseret Book. Mm-hmm. And once Sherry sort of, you know, considered that for a moment and thought, you know, that's maybe okay. despite that, they brought me on board, and I've been there for the last 2.5 years.
Awesome. And we'll talk about the vision and how much direction and all sorts of things that you get from Sherry and any higher up or whatever that might occasionally enter into your life in that interesting role. So thank you all for being here. Sterling, I'm going to ask you to do something at first, if you would. And again, I only threw this at you 10 minutes before the call, so basically, I would love to have you overview the various divisions within the Mormon community, church, etc., of content makers, you know, for especially films. So, for instance, we know the church produces temple videos, you know, for the endowment and things like this. We know they did the Meet the Mormons recently. What is the name of that division, if you're aware of it, and what's your understanding of its role? And then let's talk about, you know, BYU content and things like that, and anything that the church seems to have their hands on in terms of putting out product.
Well, the overall structure in the church in terms of producing media falls to what's called the Publishing Services Department. And Publishing Services embraces a wide range of activities, everything from translation and broadcast productions like General Conference and special broadcasts to the Film Video Division. So they're engaged in all of the official media related activities for product that's produced by the church. When you talk about content creators too, Dan, the publishing services department doesn't initiate projects. Those all come from the various church departments, like missionary or church history or the priesthood department. So essentially what happens is one of those departments will have a need for some kind of media, whether it's a web series or, you know, a large-scale documentary like Meet the Mormons, which was a first presidency project, all the way down to these individual I Am a Mormon pieces, which are essentially missionary department sponsored. and then they go to publishing services, and publishing services has got the LDS Motion Picture Studio, a studio based in the conference center, as well as editing facilities, state-of-the-art editing facilities, as well as a producers group, which is the department that I was part of, the film and video division. So all of those media needs for the various church departments, including public affairs, essentially go through the publishing services department. So that's sort of the big picture side in terms of the church producing media. A lot of people have seen, for example, the Bible videos. Those were all produced through the publishing services department. And I'm going to leave Deseret Book and Excel to Arthur. But the two other major outlets, major producers of content are Deseret Management, which is the umbrella company for companies like Deseret Book and KSL. I'll leave that to Arthur to discuss. But then the only other organization that is actively producing media for public consumption is BYU Broadcasting, and particularly BYU Television. And I think maybe most of your listeners are aware that BYU Television has in the last 3 or 4 years made some tremendous strides in terms of getting on the radar nationally with a series like Granite Flats, for example, and some other things that they've done, like their Turning Point series. But that is all under the umbrella of Brigham Young University and it's essentially overseen by the President's Council at BYU. And then the third major media producing entity would be Deseret Management.
Awesome. Now, under Publishing Services Department, I'm guessing that you have film and television and media experts. I'm just curious about the structure of that. Is the oversight or the creative decision making, how free is it versus, you know, I guess I'm getting to the larger question of, it sounds to me like Publishing Services Department would be mission driven. There would probably be budget set, and there probably isn't any worry there about making money back, right? Was that fair to
Correct.
Say that? Okay.
Yeah.
So that's not a mission. That's a mission kind of structure. But I guess that they hire a lot of professional filmmakers and television producers and all that kind of stuff. Who has there's going to have to be a first presidency or Quorum of the 12 oversight. How involved are the brethren and stuff like that?
There is each church department, and this includes publishing services, has an executive committee that consists of typically two members of the Quorum of the 12 and often a couple of 70s with a 70 as the executive director of a given department. And then there's a managing director of the department, which is a full-time church employee. So the answer as far as publishing services is concerned is, yes, there is an oversight committee that's chaired by Elder Holland. At one level or another, all of the media that goes out does get the scrutiny of at least a couple of members of the Quorum of the 12. And depending on the project, if it's a project, for example, like the Temple films that you mentioned, that typically gets the scrutiny of the full First Presidency and the
right.
full Quorum of the 12.
Right. Good. Okay. Thank you so much. But again, mission driven here. Now, when we move into BYU Broadcasting, I'm guessing it's more of a muddled picture of mission versus money making, or is it more money making than I maybe imagined?
Well, that's an interesting question because from my perspective, and again, I'm not on the inside of the organization, and I haven't been there for the last four years or more. But one of the interesting challenges that I think that BYU Broadcasting has, and particularly BYU Television, is that their mandate has been to expand their audience, beyond merely the LDS community, and create programming that's going to be watched by, you know, the world at large, whatever that means. And so one of the issues that Scott Swofford, for example, who's the director of content, Scott took my position when I left to go to the church. One of the issues that they're grappling with is whether to or how to monetize the content that they're producing. Granite Flats, for example, was just picked up by Netflix. And that's probably the first real significant, I guess what you call sale to a major media outlet that BYU Television has had. And so, you know, that raises an interesting question for the future. Because if BYU Television is going to meet the mandate that they've received from the Brethren, you know, they're going to have to find a lot more money than the church or BYU has been willing to put into it to this point. So I think this question of monetization is going to be a really significant one for them in the future, because they are a nonprofit. BYU Broadcasting's initial affiliation was with PBS. Even though BYU Television specifically is not a PBS affiliate, it's an independent web channel. So, you know, those are issues that I think are sort of spinning around at BYU Broadcasting even as we speak, and I don't think they're resolved by any stretch of the imagination.
Awesome. Arthur, would you take over for the Deseret Management piece? Are you the only entity underneath that that are competing or to produce content? Or now, with XL, it's really not even producing, is it? It's distributing.
Yeah, that's correct. And to preface this bit of the podcast and the conversation, I do have to say I've got a good friend who's a cinematographer that you know harasses me on a regular basis about, you know, how deep my priestcraft is on any given day and my participation in priestcraft, and even Virginia Pierce, the daughter of President Hinckley at one of our recent author artist banquets, you know, just raised that issue. And because at Deseret Book, we are measured by our profit and loss statements. We are expected to be a sustainable church company. That doesn't mean that the Brethren expect us to make huge amounts of money to put back into church coffers. We just have to be self-sustaining and justify our existence from a financial perspective. So the products we release always have, we're looking at the cost to create content and the cost to get it to market and the price that consumers, largely Mormon consumers in the case of Deseret Book, are paying for that content. Now, we are a part of, as Sterling mentioned, the Deseret Management Corporation, which is the parent company for Deseret News, KSL, all of the radio properties, Beneficial Life, Deseret Book, and they do have a broader mission statement. You know, when Elder Iron came and rededicated one of the buildings for DMC, he talked about the company being a force for good that reaches hundreds of millions of like-minded believers. So that doesn't mean we're just talking to Mormons. Deseret Book's audience happens to be more, the core is Mormon and even a certain kind of Mormon, some people would argue. But there is that idea that maybe we need to be thinking about content that could go wider and go beyond our borders. But at the same time, we do have to make money
now,
in order to sustain ourselves.
Right. And so when he's dedicating that, he's thinking books and music as well as film, right, where you under XL are only the film.
Yeah, that's correct. And across that array of companies, obviously, with a newspaper and a radio station and television stations, there's content being produced all of the time on different platforms. But I'm hyper-focused on film because I think it's such a powerful medium. I mean, I think it's, you know, you can get millions and millions, tens of millions of views or hundreds of millions of views on a three-minute YouTube clip. But even if that makes a bit of an impression, it's pretty easily forgotten. But if you have to sit in the dark for 2 hours and grapple with a story and grapple with characters and grapple with ideas, you know, I think the potential for film to be influential, both inside and outside of the church, is massive if we can get the right stories up on the screen. And okay. So that's kind of where it becomes really interesting for me.
Okay. Thank you. And so now the question of content producing, that's maybe happening in a lot of other divisions of Deseret Management, but Would you explain to people what a distributor means versus a filmmaker? You know.
Yeah, and this will be important going forward, and maybe you'll be more kind and more sympathetic of me when I explain it. XL, when it was purchased, was started by Jeff Simpson, and it did music and film, and its first foray into film was the release of God's Army, sort of by Richard Dutcher, and sort of kickstarted the Mormon cinema movement, if you will. And then in 2004, Deseret Book acquired XL with the caveat that it not produce films, that it was going to act solely as a distributor. So I have, as the head of XL, the only thing I can do is either negotiate with producers to enter into a distribution agreement and take some of the rights that they hold as the content creators, as the copyright holders, and use those rights to push it out to the public. And so we spend a lot of money on marketing and promoting and replicating and manufacturing films in all the different formats and ways that films can be consumed by the public. But we don't put money into production. We don't raise production dollars. And that gives makes a little bit tricky for me to go to a filmmaker and insist on any sort of changes, or even to initiate a project is a little bit difficult when we don't have skin in the game, at least not until the release phase, until the distribution phase. So our task is to market, promote, get a film out to the public, and I can kind of choose to pick up projects or not pick up projects, but I'm at the mercy of producers a little bit to be out there raising money, which is hard to do. Sometimes significant dollars to be able to create a feature film, and whatever the producers out in the world are interested in tackling and taking on in terms of stories and themes and subjects and raising the money to do that, that's sort of in their court, and we try and have a collaborative relationship, and I can kind of initiate some script projects, but when it comes to the real expensive part of physical production and principal photography, XL's not in that game.
Okay, so sometimes people, you are working with filmmakers prior to even shooting, so even at the script phase and things like that, but are you making promises to them that you would eventually pick up their film, or is it more of a, they're just trying to borrow your expertise at that point?
Mostly the latter, although there are a handful of scripts and projects that I've commissioned the director of XL Entertainment. Because we are a publishing company, so that's where the line sort of gets drawn. Because we're a publishing company as well, we can invest in stories and screenplays to an extent, unless we have a really good feeling that there's going to be enough momentum to go finance the thing, raise money from investors to get it up onto the screen. I have to be pretty cautious in what types of projects I put money into. But there's a handful of projects that we've put some money into that I don't know if we'll be able to either A, raise money for them, or B, if we did, be able to release them, based on the storylines or content, but they're worth exploring, in my view, and kind of pushing the envelope. And the agreement I make with filmmakers is, look, if XL, for whatever reason, is unable to release this, then we'll transfer the rights back to you and we'll help you find another distribution partner. So that's how I've arranged it with some certain filmmakers.
So I want to talk about the parameters for what, might disqualify a film for XL or something in a second. But are you the only distribution company that's sort of under the church's overall auspices?
We have another sister company called Covenant Communications that does a handful of films. They typically don't handle larger theatrical film distribution, typically straight to DVD. Candlelight is another that has done some LDS and some non-LDS. Hailstone is still in existence.
But Candlelight and Hailstone,
they're outside the family.
Right. So as far as being like a church-owned thing, Covenant is your only other one besides you?
That's right.
Yeah. But there's obviously lots of other little ones. But okay, so I'm curious now. So you do have the church as your boss at some level. What have they told you in terms of, what might disqualify something from being an XL distributed project?
I started off kind of jokingly saying I hadn't seen many of the films that XL had put out before, that Deseret Book was carrying. And I don't really take pride in that. At the time I did, and I've had to sort of repent and take a different approach since being there. And start to sort of engage with the content. But Sherry has not given me a lot of direction. Jeff Simpson is also back at Deseret Book after a stint at KSL and is the president there. So KSL, remember, was sort of his baby and his his thing that he launched and got off the ground. So I worried a little bit when he came back after about a year of my tenure that he might micromanage or he might kind of dictate. And they haven't really given me clear principles or guidelines. There's things that I can kind of sense would be difficult for us to do. We're not going to do any rated R films. We're not going to do films with gratuitous sex or violence or language, obviously. And so I've sort of had to come up with my own standard and my own measurement of what I think we ought to be putting time and effort behind, because it is so difficult to make a film. It is so hard to make a film. It's hard to market films. It's hard to make money in films. So if we're going to do it, I'd prefer to put that time and energy and resources into films that help people be their best selves, or at least better selves. If a film makes a Mormon want to be a better Mormon, or makes a human being want to be a better human being, then that's a film I want to take seriously. And to the extent we believe in a creator that is benevolent, but also, highly creative. If God is the creator of this world, which is so diverse and so complicated and rich, but also aesthetically pleasing and beautiful, then hopefully we try and take our craft seriously, so that we're creating art and creating films that are at least attempting to be the best pieces of art and best creations that we can have them be. So I'm looking for high production value, high craftsmanship, and then films that just make that we feel something and make us want to be better than we were before we saw the film.
Awesome.
And beyond that, there's not much criteria.
Okay, and so no one's ever come to you and say, well, if it is an LDS specific, you can tell that the setting is an LDS family, or, all the major players are LDS. We want this to be towards testimony and greater belief in the Mormon Church or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Nothing like that, I'm guessing, right? It's more just, if as long as it's consonant with our values, would that be a broad way to say that?
That's absolutely right. We've done films like the Saints and Soldiers series that are not highly religious. We released a film last year called Believe that had not only no Mormon content, but no religious content in it. There's nothing that...
And you guys were involved with Forever Strong, right, about the rugby group?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Forever Strong.
Yeah, and I think I can tell that that's what you guys do now. And maybe we're going to rush into our deeper, more meta level there. But let me do a couple things for me. The scale of XL, like how many films do you average, or do you imagine that you will soon average, being involved with each year? And then I want to kind of get into, it may not be a mandate of yours, but perhaps certain directors or certain filmmakers, have these more mission driven, like, I'm going to wrap it up into a tidy ball and you are going to come away from this film believing exactly what I want you to believe, that kind of thing. So I want to do two things. So what's the scale of XL at the moment?
We kind of have to look at the marketplace, but ideally we're releasing two theatrical films a year And for me, a theatrical release, it's a tough business when we're competing with Hollywood. When we do a theatrical release, we are in direct competition with Hollywood studios for screen space, for eyeballs, for people's money. And they have limited entertainment dollars at stake. So that's a tricky game for us. And I'm not sure the market, this is sort of a banner year for LDS filmmakers. There's a lot of films coming out in the theater. I think there's going to be four theatrical releases this year, starting with Freetown, Cokeville on June 5th, The Cokeville Miracle, which we're behind, and then Just Let Go, the true story of Chris Williams, this bishop who was hit by a teenage drunk driver, that comes out in October, and another film called Once I Was a Beehive about, young women in the church, that comes out August 14th. So there's a lot of momentum, and and whether the market can sustain that many theatrical releases, I think, you know, we'll see. But the scale for XL, I think if we could handle two theatrical releases a year and a handful of other home video products in our lineup, that's a good mix for us.
Okay. Let's talk Cokeville Miracle for a second, if we can, Arthur, and we'll use that as maybe a touchstone, along with any of the other films that you would like to kind of talk about the larger, you know, basically we're going to go to meta questions of storytelling and audience and when faith gets involved and when, you know, a director, you know, has a vision that, you know, is going to be more or less subtle or something in terms of open-ended for the audience and things like this. So tell us quickly about the Cokeville Miracle, about T.C. Christensen, the director, and just kind of the history that you have with him and why this film was picked up by you guys and things like that.
So the Cokeville Miracle is a new film by T.C. Christensen that comes out in theaters June 5th. And it's based on a true story that took place on May 16th, 1986, in a small town, Cokeville, Wyoming. A lot of people have heard of the story of the day David and Doris Young walked into a school, the elementary school in Cokeville, and rounded up all the teachers, all the students, into one classroom and held them hostage for 3 hours, demanding a ransom. David Young was a little crazy, and it was unclear whether he was really financially motivated or he had some other religious sort of cult motivations about taking these kids with him to a brave new world. And TC's decided to grapple with this story. All of the children and teachers lives were spared after the bomb was accidentally detonated. The only casualties were the two perpetrators. And it's raised a lot of questions about, you know, miracles and the nature of miracles. This is the third film for TC, feature film, that XL has released, the first being 17 Miracles in 2011, and 2013 was Ephraim's Rescue, both pioneer films that dealt with sort of the same historical touch points about the Martin and Willie Hancock companies. And so for him, this was a bit of a departure to kind of move out of the historical pioneer setting and come into a more contemporary setting. But he's addressing the same types of issues, and in many ways it's he's exploring that terrain, and are miracles really the unexplainable, and things that are divine intervention is clear cut, or is a miracle something as simple as a human being sacrificing him or herself for the larger good, which happens in each of his films at one point or another. So that's the Cokeville Miracle in a nutshell. And each of his films have been financially successful, which is not easy to do.
Right.
And we'll see if this departure, not having sort of inherent, you know, missionary films and pioneer films are sort of known to perform well, as you might expect among a Mormon audience. And this is a departure. It doesn't have any of those inherent hooks of missionaries or pioneers. So in some senses, it represents a bit of a risk for him as a filmmaker.
Yes. How are you mostly going to put this forward for the Mormon market? Or it seemed to me that if there was any Mormon content in the original scripts or whatever, you guys got rid of it, or TC got rid of it. The only real Mormon moment that I could kind of pick up from it was the kids singing a Janis Cap Perry, "Father, Are You Really There?" kind of song. It looks like you deliberately de-Mormonized it, or was it never Mormon to begin with?
Yeah, he did. He did de-Mormonize it, and I think that is a risky thing to do in some situations if the audience you're going after is Mormons. And we certainly want to capture that audience, because TC has a following, he has a fan base. It would be silly for us to not address and promote the film to that audience. But it was interesting. We took the film to Dallas and had the opportunity to screen it with a big mega church called the New Beginnings Church, and Pastor Larry Huck and Tiz Huck and their congregation came out. It was a good mix of racial demographics. I don't know about their economic demographics. but we worried that the language of the film, the TC's cinematic language, might naturally gravitate to being more Mormon or LDS. So even though you can take out some specific things, specific references, would the cinematic language still play too Mormon to be relevant to a broader Christian audience? And it was quite remarkable. People came out of that film filling out the surveys, giving it very high marks. About 98% of them scored it a 5 out of 5 as we asked them how did it rank compared to other faith-based films they'd seen. And they all gave it a 5 out of 5 and had great things to say about it. So there are some things that, you know, that there's some elements of family history and of angels coming and intervening that day, being descendants of of some of the children in the classroom, that will be very familiar to Mormons and will resonate with Mormons and our you know, emphasis on family history work. But in other ways, it is just a broader film about faith and prayer and God intervening, and when does He intervene and when doesn't He intervene and why. And I think those are hard questions. And however people come down on the film and whether it resonates with them personally in their faith journey, I think it does beg those questions, and astute viewers will come away thinking about those questions, we hope.
Yeah. Now, is this going to be a bigger chunk for you guys because you have these good results in Dallas and elsewhere? Are you going to be trying to roll out in theaters nationwide to a bigger scope than you've ever done before, or have you guys, is this charted territory for you already?
No, we're going to still maintain a pretty small release footprint. And the reason is it's expensive. It costs a lot of money. It's $1,000 a screen just to open it, just to pay the print fee, or the virtual print fee these days on digital projectors. And so, you know, when I feel as the distributor a deep obligation to help filmmakers make a return on their investment and recoup their production budgets. It's one of the key philosophies that I brought when I started at Excel. There's a lot of distributors, and Excel may have been guilty of it in the past of going out, and because of how distribution deals are structured, you know, being in a first position to recoup their marketing dollars, and they can spend too much on a film, and that puts the producer into a hole and into a bad financial position. So we want to be careful of that and not go too wide and still sort of platform this out. We will open on 50 screens and have markets in from Washington D.C. to San Diego and Orange County and Houston and Dallas. And so we're out there to try and, you know, get the film a bit wider, but still relying on the sort of Jell-O Belt and core Mormon audience to launch the film. If it does well, we can always open more theaters.
Right, good. Now, before I turn it to a wider discussion here, does Excel, or the fact that there's the Mormon brand, does that ever come up and bite you guys anymore, or are we kind of past that day where somebody may say this film is opening and it looks like it's promoting Christian values, but we really know it's the Mormons behind this, and stay away? Is that still ever a factor anymore?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. There's evangelical groups that still want nothing to do with Mormons or Mormonism. So if when it comes to kind of pushing films out into other markets, there's certain Christian distributors that have access to the Christian marketplace that love to work with us, and other ones who are a little bit more cautious and reserved in that sense. So that those biases are still out there. You know, we've released a couple of films to try and address those, documentaries that kind of show an inclination towards more tolerance and trying to understand other faiths and take them at face value and build bridges. Documentaries don't sell well for us, unfortunately, so how well that message is doing in terms of crossing over, building bridges, I don't know. But certainly we run into that bias from the evangelical community on occasion.
Hey, thanks. I'm excited to have you guys. Just questions. But I want to fold Stephen in if we can. Stephen, would you come into the discussion now with maybe you've seen the Cokeville Miracle, you've seen lots of Mormon films, you saw Freetown. What is your sense of good storytelling versus you know, some of the mistakes that can kind of get made in faith-based films or films that are definitely, you know, playing with the subject matter where there's safe conclusions and there's more adventurous conclusions, you know what I mean? Or no conclusions at all. What's your general sense of what makes a good film that would meet XL's goals as well as, you know?
I think that the best way to approach a question like that is to see what the function of the story is. I like your idea of mission-driven versus like artistic-driven or profit-driven, but I want to look at like two ideas of what a story is trying to accomplish. So in Plato's Republic, Socrates talks about how in order to run a society well, in order for a culture to function smoothly, you need to have what he called a grand myth. And basically this was the idea that if you went according to, if you behaved according to the culture's rules and principles, then the gods would bless you. And if you went against them, then the gods would curse you. And Socrates says, if this is at the foundation of your culture and everybody believes it, then it's going to work out. It's going to function smoothly. And so the merchant class, if they believe this, they're not going to use their monetary power to take over everything. And the soldier class, they're not going to try to run a coup and take over and make it into a military state. And the philosopher kings, they're not going to abuse their power because everybody is on the same page as far as if you do things according to the culture, you're blessed, and if you don't, then you're cursed. So stories are made on this level. All cultures use stories to help everybody to see what the culture's values are and to help them feel like it's really worth obeying those values. And there's a lot to be said for that. I really enjoy, for example, the fact that it's so safe to drive on interstates, even though it is kind of dangerous. The fact that everybody's pretty much on the same page as far as you really need to be safe, you need to obey the laws, blah, 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 makes it a relatively safe environment. So there's a lot to be said for that. And you know, during the early days of the church, especially when we were, you know, crossing thousands of miles and trying to set up communities in desolate places, everybody had to pull together. And they did have to have, you know, this single myth that was showing them what the culture's values were and how they could work together well. And the church did a really good job at that. And that's why it was so successful. And every other culture does this as well. Like, for example, when I was in Alaska, I studied a lot of Alaska Native stories, and they had pretty much the same thing. They would embed cultural knowledge and values in stories, and those stories were kind of what ran the culture, what made it work well. So this is one kind of stories. I'll call them like Republic stories because propaganda doesn't sound good, but that's essentially what these things are. They're propaganda. They say, this is what you need to do to fit into the culture. You should do it. But I'm going to call them Republic stories because it doesn't sound quite as bad.
Plato's Republic. Yep. Okay.
Plato's Republic. That's right. Okay. So one of the interesting things is there are a lot of people who feel like propaganda can never put out anything of artistic quality. And this is not true. Off the top of my head, I can think of a number of really excellent pieces of film propaganda. For example, Jet Li's The Hero. It's a fantastically entertaining, visually sumptuous, very well structured action martial arts movie that is about the founding of China as a unified state. And when you get to the end, you realize, oh, this is the myth of China. This is what brings everybody together so that they're all on the same page and have a similar idea of what it means to be Chinese. So a fantastic movie, out and out propaganda, but that's okay. It's a fantastic piece of work. And then, of course, we have, like, if we're willing to go way back in film history, the Battleship Potemkin. what a marvelous piece of work that was totally shoring up Bolshevikism and that's not how you say it, Bolshevism. and then Birth of a Nation, one of D.W. Griffith's just a monumentally good story and piece of film that will turn your stomach once you realize what it's about. And then, of course, there's like Fahrenheit 9/11 and Triumph of the Will. All of these are excellent pieces of filmmaking, and they're all propaganda. But it goes to show you that you can do good filmmaking if you're doing Republic-type stories. Cultural stories that say, this is what we value, and do it.
Would you at this point want to venture, has Mormonism produced any of those? Would you name any films that you see that fit into that sort of category, or is this too early in your discourse to ask that?
A discourse, is that what I'm doing right
well,
now?
Well, no, you're presenting no, a beautiful picture here.
I'm just bugging you. I haven't encountered a piece of Mormon propaganda or Republic piece of filmmaking that I felt is of really high quality as far as storytelling and everything else goes. But I would be really interested, considering I'm kind of a neophyte as far as knowing about Mormon cinema, if Arthur or Sterling can point us in those directions, because there's every possibility that there is a good one, and I need to see it.
Do you guys want to jump in if you have something in mind?
Well, I guess 2 points. One is I'm not sure that I buy in, Stephen, to your category of Republic cinema or propaganda cinema. The term propaganda, I think, is a more complex term. But what characterizes your category here is that to a significant degree, it comes from the Western tradition, which has sort of devolved from an intensely religious view, which Plato held, to what is now essentially a secular view, in terms of the kinds of measurements, I think, Dan, that you're asking for. You certainly couldn't categorize either the battleship Potemkin or Hero, I think, as deeply religious works of art or deeply religious films. So for me, the category that you've set up here, and I'm interested to hear what your second category is, or maybe my comments are pretty short. But the category, it seems to me, is biased in what I would consider to be a very much secular direction. A more helpful category for me, rather than what you call your Republic or your propaganda categories, is the category of devotional works of art. And, you know, there's a wide range in quality in terms of devotional works of art. If you look, for example, at early Christian art from the second century in Syria or in Turkey, you know, it's extraordinarily crude, and it doesn't measure up by the standards of either Romantic or Impressionistic or even Renaissance art. And so you have to ask the question, not what is the quality of the artistic achievement, but you have to ask the question, what is the intent for which the work was created? So the categories are just not quite as simple, I think, Dan, as you're making them out, and I'm going to withhold judgment on Stephen until I hear what his second category is.
Okay. Do you want to jump in, Stephen, and either offer your second category or correct Sterling on what you were actually going after?
Okay, yeah. I totally understand your critique there, Sterling, and I think that'll send us in a good direction. And you're right that I do think of religions as being a culture, and so that's why I'm willing to apply Republic or propaganda to it. But I also understand your devotion category, and I think I'm going to head in your direction now pretty quick. So the second thing, the second category I want to go into is what I want to call Christian filmmaking. But it's not what you're thinking. So most films that we call Christian or even Mormon or religious are actually followers of the Republic theory. They are there to reinforce the cultural story and to encourage conformity to it. And in many ways, the Acocville miracle is a prime example. If we look at it as sort of from a very great height, we see that the good people are miraculously preserved, the bad people die, and the doubter is brought back into the belief system that the movie is rooted in. So that's what most religious and Christian films are, because they want to make the culture run well, and they want to help people feel a sense of investment in that culture so that they will continue to make it run well. Now I'm going to talk about Christian filmmaking, my version of Christian filmmaking, which is making a movie as if you were Jesus Christ. So Jesus was kind of a much different type of person. He was always at variance with his culture in Judaism. The church leaders didn't like him. He got kicked out of church, and he never gave people answers that reinforced the way that they already thought. He was always challenging them. And the interesting thing about this is that along with this penchant for challenging people, he also proved himself to be kind of crummy at building up a church, at building up a cohesive church. It was Paul who really kept things together after Jesus died. And in fact, Mormons have this story about the great apostasy. They say, you know, Jesus came down, he established his church, and then it went into apostasy. And we say, you know, like within 30 to 50 years or something like that. And so despite Paul's efforts, what Jesus put together apparently didn't cohere well enough. And this is possibly because of the way he told stories. So for example, one day a rich young man came up to him and said, I believe, I give money to the poor, I keep the law. What else do I need to do? And so if Jesus had been like a Republic type of storyteller, he would have said, great work. You're being rewarded for doing all the right things. I'm so glad to see that you do these things that our culture approves of. You're doing great. Let's tell a story about you. But instead, he said, young man, go and utterly change your life. You need to sell all that you have and come follow me. And there were other people that he was doing this to. For example, when he one day he was walking through the street, and the chief of the of the publicans climbed up a tree and said, you know, Jesus, come to my house to eat. And Jesus, in one of probably the poorest public relations moves of his life, said, that sounds like a great idea. And so Jesus went into the home, like voluntarily went into the home of one of the most despised people in the Jewish culture. This guy was like considered a traitor. He was excommunicated from the church. And Jesus went into his house and apparently didn't call him to repentance or anything like that.
Well, it's Zacchaeus, and Zacchaeus at least says that he's an honest publican. You know, he claims I never take advantage of people. He goes, I give half of my money to the poor, mm-hmm. and if I've ever wronged anybody, I restore to them four times. And then Jesus says, well, you and your family, you and your household here are redeemed.
Exactly. But what got out to the rest of the people who were around there? Oh. If you saw this on Facebook, then it would say, Jesus goes to evil man's house, right?
Right, right.
And, you know, 22 reasons why Jesus should not have gone to Zacchaeus' house. You know, stuff like that.
Listicles.
So, yeah. So Jesus, he wasn't teaching us to be nice. He wasn't teaching us to be good. He wasn't teaching us to follow the culture. Jesus was so far beyond that. He was teaching us to wake up. He was teaching us a higher spiritual plane. And when you do that, then you need to do some crazy things. You need to challenge people the way that Jesus challenged them. If you look back onto what Jesus did, onto the way that he was interacting with people, he approached them with a great love and a great concern for their soul. and he saw where they were blind and tried to help them see what was going on. But the thing was, when he was pointing them toward what was actually going on, often it was something that you couldn't even articulate. That's why he was always telling these strange stories. You know, Paul said, "Eye hath not seen, nor hath ear heard, nor hath entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for them, those who love him." He told, what's his name, about being born again. When he used the being born again metaphor, what he was saying was, you're like a child in the womb right now. That's how you're perceiving the world. If you were perceiving it truly, it would be as if you were outside of the womb and you were seeing everything. I mean, that was the kind of stuff he was pointing us toward. So what I'm getting after is almost the impossibility of making something with a devotional intent, and I thoroughly approve of devotional intents, that actually sends us toward God and not toward the culture. A few filmmakers who come to my mind when I think of people who are making Christian film in the sense that I've just been talking about are people like Ingmar Bergman, Andrei Tarkovsky, Krzysztof Kieślowski, and Terrence Malick. So one thing that you'll probably notice about every one of these people, ooh, for one thing, they're all male. I should have thought of a female. I feel bad now. Is that all of them make movies that are kind of difficult to sit through. They require an investment. Mm-hmm. They often require multiple viewings. And they often don't put you down in a place where you say, ah, yes, this feels like an ending place. They're kind of like big slingshots that sort of sling you into, into you don't know what. So those are my two categories, Republic films and Christian films.
And then is your recommendation to Sterling and to Arthur with XL, go for Christian films and you will be wildly successful? or how do you solve the art versus, you know, or the dilemma there about some commerce has to be involved?
Well,
you know, Dan, I'm really curious why I'm curious about your Marxist underpinnings here.
Oh, okay.
Could you articulate those a little more clearly? Because this issue of capitalism seems to be an underlying theme of your concern about creating meaningful art.
It's not. Well, actually, I want it out of the way, but yet I do know and sense that lots of times decisions are made based upon audience, based upon reasons of art. And so for me, I'm much more of a, you know, I love mission driven, you know, stuff that doesn't worry about making any kind of money, you know, to do a mission, it costs money. And so I like that because that gets the commerce piece out of the way. Obviously there's still the, will I get it into any theaters? You know, will this guy, you know, sell me a screen for a week or two to show it. But as far as the filmmaking product goes, I would love to have commerce not be a concern. And so when Steven's talking about Christian films, which are, it's a wonderful category, I'm just asking him to say, do you think there money can be made from that? Because Malick and those guys generally, yeah. I mean, I think they recoup their investment just because they have a following of film aficionados, but they're...
Right, yeah.
Well, let me comment on, if I may, on the Christian filmmaking category that Steven articulated here. You know, it seems to me that there is a common thread that would pull together both what I consider films in the devotional category, which is where I think most of the Mormon films, and there are some exceptions to this, where most of the Mormon films fall. I mean, I think the notable exceptions to the sort of traditional devotional film that we're used to in North American or Wasatch Front Mormon culture are probably a couple of Richard Dutcher's films, which are certainly asking harder questions. And I frankly think one of the great tragedies of the last 20 years is losing Richard as a, you know, as a devoted member of the church. I mean, I think he was an enormously gifted filmmaker, and I think he was asking hard, interesting, difficult questions, and I think it's a real loss. But coming back to the to Stephen's category here, the thing that I think for me sort of holds a film like, for example, Ephraim's Rescue. Again, I haven't seen Cocteau Miracle, but a film like Ephraim's Rescue, which was T.C.'s previous film, in the same family as, let's say, a film like Blue, like Kieslowski's Blue, mm-hmm. or like Sacrifice, Tarkovsky's Sacrifice, mm-hmm. for example. The thing that emerges from those films, and I think from Bergman too, even though Bergman kept crossing back and forth between agnosticism and Christianity. But the thing that sort of holds all these films together in a single category for me is the issue of this yearning for transcendence. This yearning to somehow, open up a space. And I use that phrase deliberately. That was Walter Benjamin's phrase in an article he wrote, and Stephen may know it, called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. This yearning for transcendence on the part not only of Christians or Mormons, but also on the part of atheists and agnostics who are yearning for a better world, who are yearning for a better culture, who are recognizing that something's fundamentally broken in the world. And so they're trying to find a way to make sense of this brokenness, it seems to me. And I think that was very much Kieslowski's situation, especially in the pieces he did on the Decalogue. Mm-hmm. But in a sense, what the Mormon filmmakers, many of them are trying to do, and I'm thinking of Saratov Approach, I'm thinking of Freetown, whatever their artistic limitations or their, their production limitations, there is at the center of those films still this yearning to make sense of this relationship that we're striving to have with something that's transcendent. So I don't see those categories as being necessarily mutually distinct. I'm asking the question, what is the yearning on the part of the filmmaker? What's the filmmaker reaching for, even if they don't have, as Mormons believe we do, even if they don't have a definitive doctrinal answer? I think that yearning is still very powerful, and I think the Mormons feel it no less than Terrence Malick or a Krzysztof Kieslowski. Okay, end of my disquisition.
Stephen, jump
That's
back.
That's fascinating. Thank you, Sterling. I'm all over everything that you're saying. I completely agree, actually, that Freetown is actually an excellent example of sort of a hybridization of the Republic movie and the Christian movie, because on the one hand you do have everything that's needed for a faith promoting film. Missionaries managed to make it out of a very difficult situation through miraculous means, but at the same time it also brings us into difficult questions where we find out that the answer to that question is what is in our hearts. It's not, do we need to believe in this or do we believe in that, but what is in our hearts? So, for example, there's that part where they're in the car and two guys are talking about when they found out about the priesthood ban. And instead of saying, oh, well, it was all a product of the time. It was racism was everywhere back then and things like that. And going into apologetic mode, what they said was, well, we are constantly trying to get better. And I'm trying to constantly get better. The church is trying to constantly get better. And what it did was it opened a route to that yearning. We all want to be better. There was a time when we weren't as good as hopefully we are now. Hopefully we are making progress, but it is my heart that is under consideration right now. There was another time when a missionary says, terrible things have happened. Terrible things will continue to happen. The only thing we can do is say, what can we do now from our own hearts? And sure. and that is a tremendous message, because it goes into our hearts and it says, who are you? And to me, that's what Christian filmmaking is. It isn't saying you should believe this. It is saying, who are you? And not insisting on giving you the answer of who you should be, but saying, who are you? That was what Jesus was constantly asking.
Well, if I can just jump in for a second. I think it's, Stephen, it's interesting to start off with the parable of the wealthy man who comes to Christ and asks what he's lacking, what else he should do, and he goes away sorrowful, not able to give up all of his wealth and do the hard thing that Christ is challenging him to do. So it's one thing to challenge people and say, we're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to just let you figure it out. But I also think there has to, in terms of that yearning we're talking about, there has to be some real religious feeling. There has to be some religious experience. And I think that is the challenge for every filmmaker. And it's just really interesting sitting and watching, test screen after test screen. And I guess I'm jumping to the defense of Cokeville a little bit, because people walk out of those screenings deeply, deeply moved for whatever the structural or production limitations are. They walk out very moved, and I think that motivation, that spiritual motivation, has to rise to that challenge. Whatever we're being asked to do, and we are asked to be a specific thing. We're asked to be like Christ and like our Heavenly Father. But to get there, to even come close, or to get there on a given day or a given hour, we have to have that spiritual motivation, and that just comes down to the spirit and some sort of connection or yearning that's authentic and real.
Well, that raises another point for me too, and that is, Stephen, I have a poster hanging. I'm sitting in my office at my home. I have a poster hanging on the wall that was given to me by one of my other sons, who's a very much political radical. And the poster says, "Reward for information leading to the apprehension of Jesus Christ, wanted for sedition, criminal anarchy, vagrancy, conspiring to overthrow the established government, et cetera, et cetera." And, I love this poster because it is a reminder of, I think, exactly the point that you made, which I think is right, and that is that Jesus found himself essentially in a corrupt culture. And everything he tried to do was to divert people spiritually from that culture into a more transcendent direction. But here's the dilemma I have, I think, with the way you've characterized a Christian film. And this comes, Stephen, too, out of my work with Margaret Blair Young on this Heart of Africa project. Because one of the things that I've come to understand as we've worked on the fringes of Congolese religion and Congolese spiritual culture is that the individual is nothing in that culture. The entire life of the individual is defined by the community. What the individual will become, whether they have a revered place in the culture, all depends on the context of community. And one of the fundamental, one of the fundamental values of a spiritual tradition is the creation of community. And you're only giving us, in terms of your definition of Christian filmmaking, you're only giving us one note. And that note has to do with the capacity of the individual to work on or create his own personality, and to create that in a context of self-questioning. You're back to Socrates again, the unexamined life is not worth living. But what your category doesn't speak to is the creation of Christian community that's yearning for transcendence, and how that community is created and how it's maintained without tipping over into a fascist sort of, controlling organization. And I recognize that's a very fine line. So I'd be interested in having you speak to that question of what films in your pantheon address this issue of community, because Jesus was not only about the individual, but he was also about the fact that the communities that existed at the time were corrupt communities, and he was trying to recreate or create a new community from a covenant that had been broken anciently.
Good question. By the way, Sterling, I am a Kickstarter backer of Heart of Africa. I'm really excited to see it, actually.
Oh, thank you. We're working to make that a very rich, complex experience. So thank you for supporting
me, Steve. Yeah, I have total faith that that's going to be a great piece of cinema. So I really appreciate you bringing that up, because I totally agree with you that in many ways the current culture that's around, that is growing up around religion, is that a lot of it is about the individual. And you're absolutely right that there needs to be a balance between the individual and the community, because as Joseph Smith was always teaching us, we can't be saved alone. We have to be saved with everybody. He was constantly trying to knit us together one way or another, so that we would become the great family that we are. And you're right. What it means to be a part of the community and making films that bring us to that point are tremendously essential. And I would actually agree with you that there's probably a need for more community-oriented films in Mormon culture and in Western culture, especially. We need to remember the way that we're connected with each other. So, like, one of the movies that comes to mind is Junebug, even though it's kind of not really about, well, I guess there's some Christians in there, but it's about what it means to be a family, or perhaps Ordinary People, when you find out what it means to actually connect with a person. The serious vulnerability that you go into when you try to connect with people on an authentic level and be one with them. I mean, that's the entirety of what Jesus was trying to say, right? He's saying that we need to be at one with God, with each other, with ourselves, if we're cutting ourselves off. Do you have some films that have pushed you, that have done those things? Because I'd sure like to see them.
You mean in terms of the community, aspect of things? I think in a way, we've got some interesting lessons to learn. For example, I think from the tradition of films about the Jewish experience.
Oh yeah.
And then, by the way, I just want to clarify, I think there's a space in the cinematic world for both kinds of films, religious and Christian films that ask very hard questions and get us to look at ourselves in new and fresh ways. But I also think there are films, there's a place for the devotional film that helps to bond communities together.
And I completely agree.
As you rightly pointed out in your example from the Republic, helps the culture of the community to function better as a community. So I think there's space for both of those. But you see films like I'm just thinking of films like Schindler's List, for example, mm-hmm. or films like The Chosen, or Fiddler on the Roof, even though it's a musical, and that's mm-hmm. not in the category of Kieslowski or.
No, I'm totally with you.
But essentially the fundamental theme of a film like Fiddler on the Roof, which is taken from the stories by Isaac Bashev Singer, I think. Uh-huh. Shalom Aleichem. But the fundamental idea behind Fiddler on the Roof is, here's a community that's fracturing. The traditions are breaking up. The traditions are fracturing. And not necessarily, and because of the onslaught of modernism and changing political and religious values, so communities get fractured, and I think we're seeing that very much in our own time, very much in the mid as we move into the mid 21st century. So this attempt to make a film that celebrates community, I think, is a very difficult thing to do. But anyway, sorry, I'm just trundling on here.
Well, this is the point that I wasn't making this point earlier, but it brings me back to that point where, I used to have a real reluctance to embrace Mormon film, because I didn't think it was high art. I didn't think it was challenging. I thought it was didactic. And you bring up this, we're talking about this idea of community, but it has to do with how we define that community and how big is the tent that we're willing to throw over people who are different and have, different viewpoints. And to the extent we put up on film and tell stories that only reinforce a particular brand of community or, see the community in only one way, we are at risk of becoming too rigid. Absolutely. And then it's harder to bring in other people and bring them into the fold. And certainly, we've had discussions at Deseret Book, and Sherry Dew has led these discussions about, how do we come up with stories and products that address this sort of middle section of Mormon who don't really feel comfortable in the community. They don't feel like they have a place. They're not ready to leave. They have some yearning still for the church and its doctrine and for the gospel, but they're not comfortable with sort of the easy answers. And are we doing enough in terms of putting out stories and films to help those people that are struggling with real questions and legitimate questions and giving them a space to ask those questions without feeling like they're pariahs or they're going to be black marked in some way? And so I think, that's the next step of Mormon cinema that I hope we can make that leap. I think there's a need for all of the films that we've done up till now to sort of evolve to that space. And I still think in TC's films, there is that notion of community. Every time that it gets emotional, it's when somebody makes a sacrifice of themselves for the larger community. That's true in all of his films. And I think the biggest moment in the Cokeville Miracle, and the one that's most poignant for the investigating officer, is saying, look, the real miracle is people going back into the burning classroom to make sure everybody got out. And what it did for that community was the biggest point. But certainly we have to be careful, I think, of defining that community too narrowly or too rigidly, particularly when we're talking about the gospel community.
Yeah, I have to say, Arthur, it gives me so much hope to hear to hear you talking about those discussions going on.
Me too. Yeah.
that is so cool. And just in the time that I've talked with you before and now, I have total faith that I'm going to be seeing some really great things coming out of Excel. I have a lot of faith for the future.
I appreciate that, and it's a battle, it's a struggle. I mean, that's one view, and I certainly learned quickly. It's not a job where you come in swinging a sledgehammer, knocking down walls, but you kind of chip away little by little, and hope that whatever the deficiency is in any film that we may be releasing, because it's just so hard to make, so many different things that come together to tell a good story on film, all the different department heads and creatives and from script to cinematography to acting and directing, all those things. And it's so difficult that hopefully we're saying, how can we, what is the value? What is the merit in any of the efforts that have been put out? And hopefully we're moving in a good direction, but acknowledging that there's work to be done and more stories to be told that do address that sort of, middle group of, questioning, sincere questioners within the church.
That's awesome. So could you see down the road Excel releasing something like one of the Dutcher films? Probably not Falling, but at least of the first three.
They started off on that track, and I'm hopeful. I'm certainly hopeful that films like Dutcher's can be reintroduced into the pantheon of Mormon cinema. I've taken the discussion off of a very interesting intellectual track, and we can get back on that. But,
not even
bringing it back to the practicalities of my world and where I live. And I warned you, I wasn't the
No,
the smartest one in the room, but
I want to hear your reaction to the categories, because you know Sterling was both affirming of Stephen and saying, you know, your two categories didn't work for me. So let's throw out the Stephen had the two of the Republic films, the ones that kind of dealt with the whole cultural mythos. Then he had the Christian films, which were more about teaching us to see something different, to you know, to give a challenging answer, to move somebody off their comfort zone. And then Sterling came back with, you know, yearning for transcendence and devotional as a couple of categories, and then started to say, you know, something that's for and in service of the community were kind of what we had. Are there things in that those categories that you just, like, your heart was singing as you were listening to all that being thrown out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are all helpful and useful categories, but again, it comes down to it. If we challenge ourselves but aren't religiously motivated to live up to the challenge, then the challenge doesn't actually do much good, at least as far as personal salvation and personal spiritual growth is concerned. And so for me, the hallmark of a good film, however imperfect it may be, is if it evokes some sort of feeling without being too didactic or pedantic, but if there's real feeling and it's not manipulative, then I think there's merit there, and it's worth celebrating as a culture, not to turn a blind eye to any sort of valid criticism, but to support it and find out what's good and find the good in the efforts that are out there. That's important to me, and it's become important. It's something I wasn't very good at a couple of years ago. Sterling made reference to our anarchist, son and brother who's you know, spent time in Iraq and the Middle East and been on the front lines of some of the conflicts over there.
And a lot of our listeners will actually know Will, so it's Will Van Lagen.
Yeah, from the Mormon worker
and things.
Of Mormon worker fame. So I'm the brother of Will and the son of Sterling in most circles. But you know, he's a person who I think is pretty thoughtful and pretty astute thinker with a master's degree in divinity from Harvard. And you know, I bring him out to see Ephraim's Rescue. You know, 6 months into my job at XL, and think, okay, how's he going to react to this pioneer story of a guy who goes out into the plains to rescue the pioneers who were stranded out in the plains of Wyoming. And you know, towards the end of that film, when Ephraim Hanks makes the decision to turn his wagon around and go back into the blizzard and try and bring meat to those struggling saints, I turned and just looked at my brother, who just was just weeping, just tears just streaming down his face. And there's a lot of moments in that film that I struggle with. But when I saw that, I thought, okay, there's merit here. There's some religious feeling being stirred. And so you can pick apart, you know, the film from a lot of different levels. But if people are feeling something, then I think we ought to look at what that feeling is and see if we can't do something with that as a community to make ourselves better. Whether it's the Republic kind of version, where we kind of are defining what the culture should look like so we know our roles, whether it was that was going on or something else, or he was being challenged with something, I'm not sure, and I'm not sure that it matters if we're feeling something that compels us to try harder, to do more, to be more compassionate and more expansive in our views of the spiritual journeys of others. And so, like I said, I don't take quite as esoteric approach as Stephen or Sterling, but I think those are important categories to keep in mind if we're going to keep evolving as storytellers.
That's great. You know, I had it in my notes to have you and Sterling, especially somewhere along the line, and just my crude phrase on my cheat sheet here was to have you guys talk about and defend, and I think you've just done that. You've defended what you might want to call niche art, or, you know, something. In other words, it isn't needing to be the greatest art, the biggest mind blower, the expanding thing, but yet there's a role for art that has a much humbler focus and goal or something in mind like that. Does that seem fair? What you just did was saying, you know, I know that all these stories aren't perfectly told. They're not the most artistic because these directors, these storytellers, etc., you know, have, you know, a pretty clear view that, like for in the Cokeville Miracle, I think what Stephen says, the sinner or the skeptic comes home. You know, it's clear that right from the start, that's where TC wanted that character to go, you know, mm-hmm. kind of thing.
And it also happens to be true.
Right, you know, based upon that account is true,
and it was based on that character's actual real life account. So he's restrained a little bit too by what really happened, and not wanting to take too much dramatic license with the film. But you're right. I mean, I think going back to this idea of the devotional film, testimonies are a rich part of Mormon culture, and you know, they're certainly my favorite. Sacrament meetings are the first of the month, and we stand up, and you never know what you're going to get.
Right.
But there, on the good days, there's a real exchange that happens between an individual up on the pulpit, and if they're vulnerable and they're bearing authentic testimony from the Spirit, and an exchange that happens with the audience sitting there that's palpable at times, and it's real, and that's a big part of our tradition. And I think to a degree, that's what TC does with his films, is testimony. And it's tricky to sort of, you can criticize it, but you have to be, I think, careful in the ways in which you criticize somebody else's testimony, because it is so personal and so, unique to them. And whether he has the right to put that out, to the public, in the way that he does, you know, we could certainly debate, but it does impact people. And I think that tradition of testimony bearing and testimony giving, and the way that somebody's personal experience can benefit the larger community is significant. And, a lot of the survivors that have been talking about this film, I mean, it's interesting. We've had people who have been offended by the very idea of the Cokeville Miracle. They've been offended, you know, that God would intervene, and then are we suggesting that those kids had stronger faith or were more righteous than kids in other school shootings or tragedies? And some of the survivors have jumped into some of these threads and said, you know, we don't know. We don't have really easy answers. They believe that God is, his hand is involved in those other incidences. It's not just loss of life that dictates whether or not God's involved or whether a miracle has occurred. But they do say, what happened is what happened, and that is our story, and what we saw is what we saw, and it's not too unlike Joseph Smith walking out of the grove and saying, I saw what I saw, God the Father, I saw Jesus Christ, and people will be offended by that, but I think if we're open to what the testimony is, and you know, we can find some merit, and that probably is my best defense of some of the types of films that we've seen in the space as devotional film. It's devotional cinema.
Awesome. Sterling, what are some of your favorites that you would defend that are probably straight into that devotional category versus the ones that are really, you know, art for art's sake or storytelling, you know, wherever it goes kind of films?
Well, I was just, to only skirt the question slightly, Dan, I was just going to add to Arthur's comment. I fully agree with what Arthur said, but I sure would love it if we had a couple of filmmakers who were rooted in the LDS tradition, who were doing what Richard Dutcher was able to do. Because again, I think, you know, I think there are Mormons and then there are Mormons, and there are those who are absolutely rooted in the covenant community, and there are those who are struggling. And I've been so encouraged, for example, by the talks by President Ubdorf recently and by Elder Christofferson, who seem to be opening up the gates a little bit and breathing some fresh air into the church that I think is just badly needed. And so I think we need both kinds of films in our tradition. I think we need the ones that ask the hard questions about sin and about belonging and about identity and about how we connect with God or not. And then I think we need the ones that reaffirm our community, our covenant community. And I just wish, as I said, I wish we were mature enough as a church to be able to embrace both kinds of films from an economic standpoint as well as from a cultural standpoint.
Great, great comment. Maybe let's do this, because Steve and I know a pre-discussion I asked you to kind of name some favorite films of yours that you think could be a model or whatever for, you know, what happens in XL or what happens in you know, BYU, productions and things like this. Would you mind doing that? And then Sterling and Arthur, any favorite films of yours that you hold up as like something that accomplishes this sort of thing? So I'll just go to Steven and then let, I promise you guys probably no more than 15 more minutes anyway. So maybe we'll kind of end in this area.
Okay. Yeah. Just to let everybody know, I love a good devotional film just as much as the next person. Probably one of my absolute favorite films on every level is The Passion of Joan of Arc, which was a very early film. That is
amen to that.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. I love it. Every single iota of it. And it's a straight retelling of Joan of Arc and her last few days and what she went through. And that, if Mormon filmmakers used that as a template, we would be going in an excellent direction. And another one of my favorites is actually won the Oscar for Best Foreign Film. It was called Ida, IDA, and it's about a young nun.
They made that one too. Both great choices.
Yeah, just and so these are both come from the Catholic tradition, and it's just and actually Ida also had some Jewishness in there. And then one of my other favorites is The Tree of Life, Terrence Malick. It starts out with a quote from Job, and then it starts out with Paul's little devotional on charity, and it's just an exquisite film. I absolutely love the Tree of Life. And then there's another one called Of Gods and Men, which is about a little group of monks and how they interact with some local rebels and how that eventually kind of turns bad for them, but the spiritual growth that they go through. And then, of course, Sterling also mentioned The Decalogue by Klosowski. So all of those are movies that any Mormon could watch because they're all rated between G and PG-13. And then if you're willing to go into the... and then if you're willing to go into the R-rated territory, Tom Tykwer's Heaven is also one of my absolute favorite metaphors for what it is to have a savior. And then last year there was also a movie with Brendan Gleeson in it called Calvary, where he plays a priest.
Wow.
It's fantastic too. So those are the ones. Those are the overtly religious films that I think are just out of this world.
I love Calvary. I love that. Oh, that's painful, but I love it.
Could XL ever do a Calvary, Arthur?
If I had seen it, I would let you know. I'm just furiously writing and trying to furiously write down all of these films that even I've got now on my list to go do my homework and to watch and to absorb and reflect on. So, you know, I'm hopeful that we can do more and we can push the envelope a little bit, but you know, for me, you know, the couple much shorter list and simpler list. You know, I've always been very taken by sort of coming of age films, and Breaking Away is one that has been a staple in our family, and it's not religious at all, but I think there's really room for a good coming of age film in our culture. That coming of age films are always about identity, always trying to figure out your place in the world, always just trying to figure out, you know, where the tensions are between the social structures and the rules and how you see yourself. And Breaking Away is my favorite film that does that, although it's more about socioeconomics and class than it is religion. But I think the same sort of principles apply, and we've got a couple of scripts in development on that front. One in particular of a boy who is 13 when his older brother leaves on a mission and is just devastated, not prepared for that loss. It felt like a death to the writer, and so we're kind of exploring what that looks like in the 1990s Northern California surf punk skate scene. And then another film, that I look to as sort of a touch point is A River Runs Through It, which has is a religious family, but you've got a son played by Brad Pitt who is not conforming. He's not living like his pastor father would have him do. And you've got the more obedient son trying to figure out how to manage those relationships and how to help people. I mean, the fundamental question there is how do you help people that are struggling? And it's not just because he's not living the rules that he's struggling, but he's legitimately struggling in life. And how do you reach out and help people? The older brother only knows how to take him fishing. I mean, fishing's the only thing he knows to do for anybody who's struggling. But I think that's a question that's worth exploring in film and in storytelling.
Gorgeous.
So that's it for me. It's a short list.
Sterling, you want to jump in with some favorites, and especially with an eye towards Arthur and maybe our church, just our wider church, cadre of filmmakers that they might look to?
Sure. there are three films that come to mind for me. One is LDS, and two are not. The LDS film is, I think, one of the best pieces that any LDS filmmaker has done within the framework of the official church boundaries, and that's a film called Lamb of God that was directed by Russ Holt many years ago. I mean, Russ did that with such a sure hand and with such clarity in terms of interpreting the New Testament story of the Passion of the Christ. And that's always been a piece that I've gone back to because I felt the confidence of the filmmaker taking me through the story, and I thought was a very assured piece of work, but again within those very narrow institutional boundaries. The other two films that have meant a lot to me in the context of our discussion, one is a Japanese film made in the early 50s that won the Silver Bear at Venice Film Festival. It's called Ugetsu. The full title of the film is Ugetsu Monogatari by the great Japanese director Mizoguchi, and it's a film about sin and about loss, but also it's about how redemption ultimately is not merely a function of mortality, but redemption involves those on the other side in the next world as well, and it was just a revelation to me. And then the third film. I had the privilege of making two films with a wonderful screenwriter named Horton Foote. Horton won an Oscar for To Kill a Mockingbird. And then he did, before I worked with him, he wrote a film called Tender Mercies that was directed by Bruce Beresford, won an Oscar, another Oscar for himself as the writer and an Oscar for Robert Duvall. And this is an extraordinarily understated film that doesn't pull any punches about loss and about why terrible things happen to people. And yet the hope in the film is built not into the dialogue, but the hope is built into the very structure of the story. And it's my wife and I just watched it again the other night, and it holds up really, really well. And it's a film that continues to inspire me, maybe not least because I had the privilege of working with Horton on a couple of films. So anyway, those are my three: Lamb of God, Ugetsu Monogatari, and Tender Mercies.
Yeah, we have studied Tender Mercies, the screenplay of Tender Mercies in my MFA because of what a great film it is. And I totally agree with you. It's tremendous.
Thank you. Yeah.
I've got some new ones to watch too, Arthur. Watch them together.
That's right.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fun. Well, yeah, I don't really have any kind of expertise for you guys, but I'll let you know of three that at least have... Well, there's two movies that I can't recommend in terms of ever fitting in your model, you know, Excel's ability, because one is like the, you know, really very difficult movie called The Rapture. I don't know if any of you guys know that, but very morally bankrupt characters. It ends up in a very super fundamentalist, charismatic kind of religious thing, and then with some crazy surprises in it. But and then Jesus of Montreal was one of the most powerful experiences of my life in terms of just rethinking the Jesus story, rethinking the origins of the Christian church. But again, it's got some language and a little bit of skin that I think would keep us out of it. So with those caveats, I'll just throw those aside. But three that I think might work is Babette's Feast. I'm sure that most of you are familiar
with
that.
Yeah, that's a great one.
Just as a beautiful, you know, for, you know, community coming together, people offering gifts, the depth of individual humans. Pieces of April, which is the film with... Katie Holmes, who's kind of the wayward daughter and invites her family for the Thanksgiving dinner. And basically she's estranged from them all. And just this whole kind of coming together of a family. Pieces of April was very powerful for me in terms of kind of spiritual experience. And then the last one, to me, I don't know if I fully embraced the film as much as I did after seeing Brigham City from Richard Dutcher, but I remember being very moved, and I'm still moved every time I see it again, the Sally Field film called Places in the Heart.
Oh, sure.
Especially that final scene, which is so reminiscent to the end of Brigham City, of how community and the ritual of the sacrament or the communion cup, you know, as a time and a place of reconciliation. So that was a powerful film for me, probably before, but probably even more so after seeing Richard's film.
I think the Beast, and Places in the Heart, those are great examples of films that celebrate community, of spiritual community, is just great examples. Good thinking, yeah.
Well, you guys are amazing. This is a neat moment. Arthur, you had my heart singing like you did with Stephen about some of the conversations you guys are having there at Excel about how to expand. I'm thrilled to learn more about just the commission that you guys are giving or being given there for the Deseret, management, corporation.
Family,
just the family of there. And I appreciate the passion which you and your dad especially have really said, you know, films that move you, you know, there's something to be said about that, whether or not they're, you know, like you said, you were always trying to say, as long as it's not overly didactic, I don't want it preachy, we don't want the sledgehammer, the only, you know, you obviously have a taste and an ear for that, but it isn't a bad thing when somebody comes out of a theater moved and determined to somehow do better. So I appreciate that you guys working so well in that industry, and we're grateful that you're there at Excel, Arthur.
Oh, thank you. I'll take that back to work tomorrow, Tuesday, and we'll keep the fight going.
Keep plugging.
We can make some progress.
Yeah. Keep plugging. Yeah, you're doing a great job, Arthur. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both. Thanks for the time. And whether Cokeville is that for everybody, the only way you'll know is go see it, and hopefully it does raise questions, even if you don't have the same emotional response to it as other people. If people are thinking a little bit about their relationship and the role of God in our lives, then maybe it's worth something.
Yeah. Let's just say that again. It opens June 5th. If you're in Utah, you'll have pretty easy chance of seeing it. You'll have to look a little harder in other cities, but. It was a couple of hour experience in the theater, and I definitely left thinking about it. You know, I have certain critiques about about it and things like that. So it's not an unequivocal endorsement kind of thing, but it caused me to rethink some things. And I was certainly glad to learn about the whole Colkeville incident. It was fun to see Michelle King from the 1980s, in the news footage that snuck in there and things like that. So I had a good time at the screening. And so again, thank you to Chelsea Robarge Fife for helping bring this panel together as well. Let me also say again, Freetown, that we've also discussed in here, will be available through XL Distributing on DVD and Blu-ray August 4th. So watch for that at various places as well. Sterling, thank you for all your work and your wisdom, and everything you said here tonight was just showed this amazing depth and richness, and boy, what a gift you are to all of us. So thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for inviting me into the conversation. I appreciated it.
Great time, and a father of a couple of really amazing guys. I don't know how many other kids you have, but I bet they're equally really something. But I've certainly admired Will for years, and it's fun to get to know Arthur a little bit here.
Well, thanks.
Well, Dan, thanks for what you're doing, Dan. It's an important part of the community to have these kinds of discussions. So it's, you're taking on a big laboring war. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Stephen Carter, you're the man. You throw stuff out there, and it always blows my brain open. So I'm grateful for every contribution you made today, and your great heart and spirit and insight.
Thanks for inviting me, man. It's always fun.
Listeners, please come to the website, mormonmatters.org, and leave your comments about this. Ask questions. If you have something directed for one of these other guys, I will make sure that they at least know that you would ask a specific question, and see if they might come onto the website and then respond as well. But please see movies, support films, support Heart of Africa. There's lots of ways for you to support and to be a part in helping to shape Mormon cinema going forward. Good Mormon storytelling. I loved that this was a cynicism-free discussion, and that's what the way we should we should do that. You know, we know that. One of you even used it as an example today, but somebody just said something that simply said, you know, yeah, we are, the past is the past, it's what it is, and we just move forward and we do better. I think it was you talking about Freetown, wasn't it,
yeah,
Stephen?
Yeah, that
was the comment there today. But I just really think that's an important thing. So for Mormon Matters and the platform that this is, I just hope that that's something that we can all do, is let's keep our eyes moved forward and make our part and not wallow in all the woulda, coulda, shouldas. And when there's nothing's 100% pure and nothing's 100% perfect, and so we just we grab what's good and move forward. And I think what's happening at XL promises in that direction. So anyway, I'll just close and thank listeners for all your support for Mormon Matters, and wish you all a good night. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well. All is well. All is well.